Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 19th of April. All things political, Monday at 9. We have a lot to talk about this hour. Our guest is Professor Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University, author of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. Professor Zelizer writes extensively for CNN.com and many opinion pieces in many other newspapers. He's talked recently about the president's strong commitment to nuclear arms control. He's talked about Michael Steele at the head of the RNC and how problematic his tenure has become. He's talked about health care reform and saying that this is not the end of the political struggle. It's just the beginning of a new chapter. Confidence in Congress at an all-time low, according to a poll released today. Of course, the regulation of the banking industry, the Senate is taking up that issue, and there is a lot of news on that front. And, the Supreme Court. Times had an interesting piece yesterday on Obama versus Roberts. We'll also talk about the Tea Party movement. Well, we have so much to talk about. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that as well. And that's talk@wpr.org. Talk@wpr.org. Professor Julian Zelizer, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
How are you?
Terrific.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. We have a lot to talk about. Why don't we start with what's happening with the banking industry, financial reform, and a growing scandal, if that's possible, at Goldman Sachs. What exactly do the Democrats want to do when it comes to financial reform?
Well, the first thing they are now going to do, it looks like some kind of public investigation or hearing into what happened at Goldman, in addition to the legislation that they're dealing with. The second is to enact some kind of more stringent rules and regulations to deal with the risky types of investments that led to September 2008, and that some see as part of the culture that allowed Goldman to allegedly take these kinds of actions. So just more stringent rules on what risks are tolerable and which aren't.
Mm-hmm. And there is significant Republican opposition to this. Mitch McConnell saying the president is trying to politicize the issue, defending his argument that the Democratic bill would institutionalize taxpayer bailouts of big banks.
Yeah, I mean, the Republicans are trying to take a difficult position. I mean, on the one hand, in the past few months, they have really supported the argument that the major bailout for Wall Street was just that. It wasn't really fixing the problem. It was just supporting the Wall Street companies that had and saving the Wall Street companies that had gotten the nation into so much trouble. But then, on the other hand, now they're saying they won't support further reforms, claiming that this is just more of a bailout. Some Republicans are not with Mitch McConnell. There's many who are uneasy with what he's doing because it's very easy to see how this could backfire on the GOP.
Right. Well, it's also one of the things that has a lot of Americans extremely upset, particularly members of the Tea Party movement, and a lot of Republicans are going to need their support come November.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, look, the Tea Party has many issues that motivate them, but this has been one of the issues they talk about, kind of the idea that Washington, whether it was under Barack Obama or George W. Bush, was more concerned about Wall Street than Main Street. And when it came to saving the economy, they were willing to send TARP money, which was the bailout program, to the Wall Street companies, but not to do as much about homeowners or those who are unemployed. You know, Republicans, again, who have tried to present themselves as the party of the people, have capitalized on that anger and that argument. But here, if they prevent a reform and it's not seen as just helping Wall Street, but actually stabilizing the market, they could look like the ones who are, in fact, protecting, the financiers.
Right. And the president certainly charged right into another big issue after health care reform.
It is two issues. I mean, after health care, I think a lot of people thought he would be quiet and almost, wait until 2010. The midterms were over, expecting losses, but hopefully not making things worse. Now he has domestically, financial regulation. On the international front, he's brought nuclear arms and nuclear proliferation back. So all of a sudden, at a moment we thought the presidency would kind of scale back, he's done just the opposite. And with financial regulation getting into an extraordinarily contentious issue, and one where if there's any effect on the markets, could become, you know, politically difficult for one party or the other.
Mm-hmm. You wrote recently about health care reform, saying this is not the end of the political struggle. It's just the start of a new chapter. Future Congresses could erode or undercut the law. I want you to elaborate on that. And also, if the Supreme Court is going to take up this issue, I read somewhere recently they are, but the chances of their overruling this?
I think the Supreme Court threat isn't that great. I mean, people have talked about the legal challenge that opponents are now going to mount and whether the Supreme Court will somehow knock down the program. Most legal experts are not saying that's a very viable threat. I think the bigger threat is in the legislative arena, not in the courts, meaning any program, even after it's passed, always remains vulnerable. The program has to be put into place. It has to work well, because if you generate high expectations about what a program's going to do, and then in the first few years it stumbles, opponents can capitalize on that. But even more important with this bill, most of the benefits don't go into effect until 2014. It's a very odd bill, meaning, you know, you have all this drama about passing it. Some of the program will go into effect, but most Americans won't see tangible benefits until two more elections have passed. So that creates a very vulnerable political bill. Republicans have two entire election cycles to attack what is yet to come.
Should Democrats have tried in some way, Professor Zelizer, to speed that process up?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there were various reasons they did it this way. One was that this made it cheaper in the first 10 years, which helped with the estimates that kept coming out of Congress about how much this would cost. But there are many critics, you know, liberals, moderates, who think it was a mistake that if you're going to pass something this explosive in this volatile political arena, it's important not to delay benefits so long. Medicare literally took 1 year to put into effect. From the time of passage, 1 year later, the program was up and running. And Lyndon Johnson had been very cognizant of this, that it would diminish the time opponents had to attack him, because once benefits start rolling in, it's much harder to attack a program. And many more Americans might say, hey, you know, this program's pretty good. Don't take my benefits away.
Right.
But until that happens, Republicans can draw on the same arguments they've been using over the past year.
We haven't heard the bill passed. We were consumed with it for well over a year. We haven't heard a whole lot about it lately. Are people who are opposed to it just simmering and waiting to take revenge in some way?
I think there's some of that. I think, you know, after you have a political fight like this, you know, both sides kind of sit on the sidelines a little bit. And, you know, the battle's over and they're trying to figure out what to do next. But I think the opponents are essentially prepared to use this bill against the Democrats both in 2010 and 2012 at the same time they actually try to undermine it. So I think Republicans are just taking a time out, giving a little time for things to simmer. Democrats and the administration in particular is working on getting this up and running. I mean, there was an article in the Times today about the various players who were involved. They are working behind the scenes to make sure this runs smoothly. But the political fire is still there. I think you're just seeing a little break.
The president going to campaign for Senator Barbara Boxer, whose seat I would never have imagined is in trouble, is evidently in trouble.
Mm. Well, Congress has taken a hit with this bill. You know, Democrats in Congress, and if a Boxer is in trouble, you know, Democrats are nervous, are not coming out of this struggle over health care in good shape politically. You know, there was a lot of excitement after the bill passed. Many Democrats breathed a sigh of relief. But the fact is, the polls on Congress, as the one that came out today, are horrible. Many constituents are very mad with Democrats about this bill. Even a victory can sometimes be costly. And I think a lot of Democrats are sensing this. And right now, from independents to conservatives to even liberals, Democrats are finding many different constituencies who are not particularly happy with what has happened. So a lot of incumbents are ironically coming out of this major victory fearing their seats. And if a boxer is in trouble right now, at a moment you'd think she's secure, you can imagine what that does to people who are in seats that are not so safe,
right,
and who have, you know, more volatile constituencies.
We're attempting to get Andy Cohut on tomorrow to talk about this death satisfaction at an all-time record high with Congress. I still am trying to understand what is the source of this incredible discontent. It has to be more than health care.
It is. I mean, there's different factors. It's important to remember that historically the ratings of Congress are always low. It's just a matter of how bad they are. There's very few moments in a modern American history since we've had polling that people think well of Congress. And you always have this dynamic where people love their members, vote for their members, but hate the institution. So on the one hand, you have some reaction against things they have done, whether why are they not doing more on unemployment, why did they pass health care, are they going to raise taxes, those kinds of issues. Part of it, ironically, is the more people see of Congress, the more it's doing, the more they see of it, and often they don't like the democratic process. Congress has been very active in the past year, and people have seen the ins and outs of earmarks and deal-making and sausage-making, as it's compared to, and I think they just don't like the process we depend on. So there's kind of an irony in that the more Congress does, sometimes the more people become upset with it.
It's All Things Political this hour. Professor Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton, is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Kevin from Toma, our first caller. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I am tired of the bailouts, and I would say that the Tea Party has captured my attention, and I really like to hear what they have to say. I am absolutely frustrated with, you know, that these Democrats are talking about extending unemployment. Obama wants to extend it till the end of the year. Now, I don't know about the rest of the country, but I can tell you in my neighborhood, I know two people that have been on unemployment for 2 years. Now they've been collecting unemployment benefits. I've asked my neighbor, I've said, they're talking about struggling and stuff. I go, well, you can go get a job at the Walmart DC. They're hiring. No, if I do that, I lose my unemployment. This whole idea that the government is going to bail you out, the government's going to take care of you, I'm absolutely just fit to be tied about it. And another thing is I deal a lot with financial institutions, and when they're talking about regulation and whatnot, let's not confuse the mortgage industry, the mortgage market, with business and whatnot. A lot of the mortgage problems that happened were people that got houses that could not afford them, and these financial institutions that took up these high-risk loans. Now, you got a lot of businesses out there that want to go out and want to lend money to businesses, but are hamstrung, are not able to, because when the bank examiners come in, the regulations are so strict that there is this very difficult, and I can tell you it's very difficult to get this money out to these businesses that create jobs. And on top of it, the people out there that are able to get these loans are absolutely scared to go and put the money and invest in their businesses because of the climate right now with just how crazy everything is. Something needs to be done, and I would say it needs to start out with a control of spending.
Professor Zelizer.
There's three different elements to the Tea Party movement. One is just a basic conservative philosophy that some members have, which I think Kevin is articulating. I mean, that's the argument with President Obama. Ultimately, he has put government back on the table, whether you're talking about regulating Wall Street or health care. He's made an argument, and Democrats have made an argument that it's dangerous to remove government from the equation. So that reflects one argument that we're going to hear coming out of the movement. A second, which sometimes contradicts it, is that the government isn't doing enough about unemployment, which in the end requires government to do something. and a kind of frustration with the uncertainty and the fears that still exist in many parts of this country. The final element, which is not what Kevin is talking about, is a kind of extremist element. There are certain elements of the Tea Party that are clearly tied to white extremist organizations. So I think what we have to watch is, where does the Tea Party move? Where does the Republican Party move? I think those are the kinds of arguments that he has laid out, which actually would be fine going into the election. And I think you'd see a very vibrant debate. I think many Democrats would respond, you know, well, that's what got us into the meltdown, that if you take government out and you deregulate everything, business does bad things. And that's exactly why you need more government. So we have to see what kind of debate we have in the next few months.
I'm trying to figure out the effect that Tea Party advocates, first of all, how many there are in this country, their dealings with the Republican Party, Republican elected officials playing to them and needing how many of their votes in order to be successful. Are they a thorn in the side of mainstream Republican Party people, do you think, or not?
Well, the Republican Party thus far has embraced the Tea Party movement. I mean, I think you've had mainstream leaders from Mitch McConnell to Sarah Palin who are courting the movement. They are not distancing themselves, and I think they have felt that the movement has re-energized the GOP, re-energized American conservatism after an election in 2008 where it seemed dead, where people were talking about the end of the Reagan Revolution. But I think many Republicans are nervous about this because they see the Tea Party movement, quote-unquote, is not a movement. It includes many different elements, different factions, and some of those could, you know, devastate the Republican Party. If the Republican Party is seen as far-right and extremist and tied with even racist organizations in an age of an African-American president, it could be quite devastating to the idea of broadening the Republican coalition. So I think, you know, Republican leaders are trying to tiptoe this issue, and they're hoping they could kind of control and define which parts of this movement they ally with.
Right. More full calls in a moment. It's All Things Political for this Monday, the 19th of April. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Monday, John Francis will be joining us. John has a very interesting story after witnessing a very serious oil spill in San Francisco quite a few years ago. He decided that he was going to do something. He did for 22 years, not ride in any kind of motorized vehicle. He took a vow of silence, at which point he went all through college and got his PhD, and he walked across the United States and walked to South America to draw attention to what one person can do to draw awareness to an issue. He will be with us the second hour of our program. And this hour, it's All Things Political with Professor Julian Zelizer. I do want to tell you, we have an email, too, in case you it's up and running, in case you can't get to a phone or you can't get through. That address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Our next caller is Marty from Eau Claire. Hello, Marty.
Hello, Kathleen. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you. I just wanted to address your point. You had said that all this anger can't necessarily just be about the health care bill. And as someone I consider a true independent, I voted both for Democrats and Republicans. It's not just about the healthcare movement. It seems to be that the whole idea of bipartisanship is dead, and maybe has been for the past, you know, 8 to 10 election cycles. And I think the average independent like myself is just kind of sick of government the way it's run being so partisan on either side. And what we really want to see is people getting together, politicians getting together, and doing what we elected them to do, and that's to pass laws and bills that are good for the majority of the country. You know, I guess that's where some of the anger stems from. It certainly stems where some of my anger comes from.
I think there's a lot of truth in that. There's very little bipartisanship, Professor Zelizer.
Yeah, there's very little bipartisanship. That angers independent voters. That's something that President Obama himself had campaigned on. The problem is what to do about it. There's a consensus that it's not good for the institution or for our political system. The problem is neither party finds the incentive to agree with each other. Even when, you know, many members of the party like on an issue with financial regulation where there is agreement, the party leadership really clamps down on their members and says you're not going to get the campaign funds, you're not going to get the positive media time if you vote against us. And so, you know, it's hard to achieve bipartisanship if no one wants to actually do it in Washington. And so it's a constant cycle. And, you know, if you're a Republican, it's hard to find evidence, I think, that the Republicans have been willing to play ball with the Democrats and vice versa. So those kinds of changes that the caller is talking about really require political reforms to get at the root of why the parties act like this.
Right.
It's not about individual members. It's about how the system works, from campaign finance to gerrymandered districts. Unless we deal with reform, you're always going to have this outcome, at least for the next, 5-10 years.
And where do you see a real gap, Marty, in what you'd like to have Congress do, Republicans and Democrats together? What are the issues?
And obviously, healthcare is a very important one. You know, that affects virtually everybody in this country. Financial reform is certainly important. But I think they're so, as the professor mentioned, they're so pigeonholed into, if you don't vote along party lines, you know, you won't get that positive press, you won't get the additional fundraising. And they tend to forget what they're there to do, and that's to do the will of the American people. And they're more interested in just keeping their jobs. So, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marty. Thanks for the call. This is no small matter, and I know you've written about it. Can we talk for a few moments about the meeting of the world leaders in Washington that President Obama put together to deal with nuclear arms control? This is an issue. I don't know how big an issue it is with the American public. It is a very important issue and has been for quite some years with the president.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think the president ran for the position to have to save the economy. That wasn't, you know, originally what he hoped to deal with. And health care reform, which he believes in and cares about, it wasn't one of the issues that animated him early in his life. He just saw it as a key issue. Controlling nuclear weapons is something, by all accounts, that Barack Obama has cared very much about for a long time and has been committed to doing something about once he was president. So this summit, I think if you watched it all on television or heard on the radio, you saw a kind of animated president or engaged president in a way that has been absent on many other issues. He fundamentally believes that one of the greatest threats we face as a nation and as a world is the spread of nuclear weapons in the post-Cold War era into the hands of, you know, small networks of terrorists who will use these and are much harder to control. And he really believes there needs to be international cooperation to prevent this from happening. So this summit, I think, is extremely important to who Barack Obama is.
And what do you think of that issue? Is it the most serious threat we face?
I don't know. I mean, it certainly is. I mean, having nuclear weapons anywhere, whether it's controlled by the old Soviet Union or it's controlled now by Al-Qaeda, is not a good thing. It poses the biggest danger we have. You just study history, like the Cuban Missile Crisis, and you could see how far things can get. It is a huge danger, but the reality of the world is terrorists can use much smaller weapons, much smaller kinds of devices to cause all kinds of chaos as well. And in this day and age, we have to fear, you know, a bomb in a shopping mall as much as a nuclear bomb being launched from some country. So the threats are multiple. But clearly, you know, it's not just about nuclear weapons. Part of what the president wants to do is create and generate international dialogue and international cooperation. It's the only way to stem the threat of terrorism. If countries don't work together, this just won't work. It's the only way, you know, to catch the bad guys, so to speak.
Was the summit successful?
I think in general it didn't produce any kind of real concrete agreement. It's just basically a statement of principles. But we haven't had anything like this for a while. We've been in a period where international dialogue has broken down. So I think, A, in just getting people together, that was good, and B, in putting the issue on the agenda, which is something presidents do well, I think it was a success.
Ray is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Didn't the president bar the press from that meeting? I mean, he ran on openness in government, and he has been about as deceitful on that issue as anybody in the past has been. He has put more things into you know, into secrecy for the next 100 years. We're never going to know what him and Bush have been doing. But I, as a liberal, am very angry at the fact that he refuses to pressure the courts into pursuing torture charges against Bush and Cheney. And I think the reason he's refusing that is because it would also implicate some top-ranking Democrats who also knew about the torture but apparently didn't want to do anything. And I would like to mention the health care thing. I, as a liberal, am very disappointed in the health care bill because it keeps the parasitic middleman in there who does zero. The insurance companies, they don't diagnose, they don't treat. All they're doing is shuffling our money around and dispersing it amongst themselves. Why would he have left that giant blood-sucking leech sucking off the American public? The health care bill has put them in the green for the next how long? You know, when will it be repealed? It doesn't look like it's going to be repealed.
The anger on the left is there. Until Ray said he was a liberal, I wasn't sure which political perspective he was coming from, and that indicates a problem for the president. There's been various criticisms raised from the left. One is a lack of openness in government. I'm not sure it's the most secret presidency we've had yet. I think the verdict's out, especially compared to the previous presidency. But clearly, President Obama has not kind of moved on a series of reforms that he had been committed to in the campaign, from openness to campaign finance reform. Liberals are also upset about the fact that the war on terrorism doesn't look that different in 2010 than it did in 2007 or 2008. The fact is Obama has been a pragmatist, and he's essentially extended, protected, and followed and abided by the war on terrorism that he inherited on issues like interrogation. And finally, health care. There are many liberals in the end who supported the bill only because they wanted a Democratic victory. They saw the danger of President Obama suffering a defeat and thought that some reform was better than no reform. But this is essentially a reform that works within the private health care system. And that is risky because it's based on all kinds of assumptions about being able to control an industry that has been uncontrollable. And so I think there are many liberals, you know, some didn't support the bill at all, but others like Howard Dean ultimately said they would vote for it. You know, he's not in office, but he lent his support in that respect. But I think there's a lot of tension. There's also tension over the issue of homosexuality, where even with President Obama's recent decision on hospital visits, there's a sense he hasn't been as committed to that issue. Now it's not a huge threat. I don't think anyone's going to run against Obama in 2012, but you want liberals energized, not deflated, going into a midterm election. And I think Obama has to do something about that.
What should he do?
Well, I think the Supreme Court nomination is going to be one opportunity for him to act based on his conviction rather than just on pure political calculation. And I think if he picks someone, the Democrats, not just the far left, but the Democrats broadly are comfortable with, I think he could kind of enthuse some of the people who are not happy with him, get behind him in an important fight. If he chooses someone that is just not very exciting or even worse, someone who many liberals oppose, they see as a kind of Bush-lite appointment, I think then he would make a mistake. So I think on this appointment, he really needs someone that doesn't anger the left, which is a tough task. But I do think it's going to be important.
Do you think he's swaying that way partially because he's so angry about corporations and campaign contributions?
Yeah, that was a decision which, you know, he literally reprimanded the Supreme Court right in front of them, and it clearly did anger him. I do think he feels that many of the recent appointees are conservative activists, and so there's a part of Barack Obama who wants to respond with a strong pick of his own. And I do think there's a, and this is just an interpretation, but at some point Barack Obama wants to do what Barack Obama wants to do. After a tough year where he's been forced to give in to the political realities of Washington. So a court pick is somewhere where the president has a little bit more latitude. So we'll see in the end, though, where he goes.
Mm-hmm. When's he making that decision? Do you know?
I have no idea. They sometimes come quickly, and but so far there's, you know, we have four appointees that have been circulating in the newspapers, but that means there's a few others you don't hear about who might in fact be the pick. I don't think he wants to wait too long. We're on a kind of tight political time clock now. We just keep getting closer and closer to the midterm elections, and I think, you know, there would be value for the Democrats if they could get this over with earlier rather than too far into the fall. Certainly they'd like to have it wrapped up and move on to other issues and move on to campaigning.
Thanks, Ray, for your call. Mike from Appleton, hi.
Yeah, good morning. I only hope you give me as much time as you gave your last two callers. There was an article that came out in the front page of the New York Times yesterday, a memo, a secret memo written by Bill Gates with regards to the apparent lack of a strategy that we have with Iran. And I'd really like your guest's comment on the fact that this may be something that is out of our control, because my feeling is that Israel has drawn a line in the sand, and they're not going to let Iran get beyond that, and they're going to do something, and which, of course, is going to draw us in. How do you think the Obama administration is going to handle that one?
Well, Gates kind of followed up on that, which is just worth noting, and argued that the story yesterday was taken a bit out of context, as he was just trying to lay out various scenarios about what needs to take place. But Iran is clearly an incredibly difficult problem. I think there is a consensus that there is a threat that exists, and there is will in Iran to develop nuclear weapons, and then it gets down to what to do about it. So the tension between Israel, which has a much more proactive stance and fears the threat of Iran, I think, more than the U.S. does, it seems at least more prepared to take military action early on, as they did with Iraq back in the early 1980s when they took out a nuclear facility. On the other hand, Obama has been more cautious, still preferring aggressive international sanctions, some kind of diplomacy to at least try to defuse this without a military strike. You know, there's all kinds of speculation. Are there deals made where basically if Israel took some kind of military action, you know, publicly Obama might be frustrated, but in fact he'd be relieved, and whether he's green-lighted something like this, that's all in the realm of speculation at this point. You know, that's the kind of diplomatic politics it takes years to unpack. I don't think Israel and Obama are as far off, though, as you might think, on wanting to calm this threat. I don't think Obama wants to deal with this for the next 2 years or the next 6 years. My guess, if there was some kind of military strike, there wouldn't be a very strong response from the administration.
We got a couple emails here. Let's go to this one that has to do with we're blaming the victims. I'd like for you, Professor, the email writer says, to refute the belief that the mortgage crisis was caused by people who weren't qualified to receive mortgages being given mortgages by lenders. Washington Mutual employees have testified to falsifying applicants' documents so they would qualify for loans. This is not the applicant's fault. The truth of the matter, and this has been researched and documented, was evidenced by Friday night's episode of Bill Moyer's Journal. The mortgage crisis was caused by extreme greed of Wall Street looking for new investment vehicles that could build their profits. I am sick, capitalized, of people continuing to blame the victims in this crisis.
I think that's been a lot of people feel that way. There was a Saturday Night Live skittle like a year ago that kind of played on that idea of people just making bad decisions and that being at the heart of the crisis. The fact is, every look we have at the housing industry shows there was all kinds of rampant speculation by the people giving loans, all kinds of, you know, shady practices at best. Illegal practices at worst in terms of what people were told about loans and really trying to strongly encourage people who shouldn't take them to take them with false promises or false expectations. So I think the weight of the blame still has to be on industry. They're the ones with the power. They're the ones ultimately that could easily have restrained themselves. And I do think it's a mistake to kind of somehow portray this whole collapse of very powerful financial institutions that ultimately lost their money as being because of people who were trying to buy a home and trying to survive. I think anyone who's been through the home purchasing process sees there's many areas where the information you're getting is incomplete at best.
You're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Our guest this hour is Professor Julian Zelizer. He joins us frequently. He's a professor of history, public affairs, Princeton University, author of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. Our number, 800-486-8655, our email talk@wpr.org, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to your phone calls, 800-486-8655. Mark from Richland Center, hello.
Good morning. I'm wondering if the story about what's going on starting today, a conference called for by Evo Morales in Bolivia, is going to be part of the political discussion in this country. He called for it as a response to what he thought was the inaction of countries mostly driven by corporate interests in the Copenhagen climate change agreement. He didn't sign on for it. Neither did the president of Ecuador. They've both been penalized by our government with funding that's been withheld from them as a result of their refusal to sign the agreement, but it's an extremely important subject because climate change and the rights of the planet and the rights of indigenous people, the rights of poor people, are just as important, but not given credit, especially for the most part in our press, because our press is so heavily controlled by corporate interests. So I'm wondering if we're going to talk about this issue with regard to what's going on this week in Bolivia.
I don't know as much about the call. I saw a story in the AFP about this. My guess is, unfortunately, what is pressing internationally is not always what's possible domestically. And it's still very hard to see climate change getting much attention in the next few months. I think now that financial regulation and the Supreme Court pick have entered onto the agenda, I don't think there's going to be a lot of Senate support for picking up on the climate change legislation, even with news coming out of Bolivia that has been put on the shelf for a while. I think we saw this with immigration reform. Senator Reid brought it up for about a day before he put it back on the shelf, and I think climate change is going to be the same. It's unfortunately going to be a very difficult issue to discuss in the current schedule and climate until after 2010.
Thank you, Mark, very much for the call. It's a story we'll look into more fully and do a show on that probably. Scott from Sturgeon Bay, hi.
Good morning. I just had two quick points. One of them regarding basically the attitude and the temper of the electorate right now. I think what it is, and I kind of relate it to gasoline prices. Once gasoline hit about $4 a gallon, the American public changed its tone. I mean, they started buying smaller cars, started conserving more. It was like that tipping point. And I think what you're seeing right now is you've got a government that's willing to spend money that we don't have, and the deficit being so great. And I think maybe Americans, the general population, has kind of hit that tipping point where they're very concerned about the debt. You look at California, what's going on, and you can't blame that on the federal government, but California's been in a state of disarray for years now because of how they run their state government by spending far more than they have. That's point number one. And point number two is, I'd like to go back to the Supreme Court, which is really going to be an interesting battle, I think, because the narrative is that he needs to nominate a liberal, which kind of is interesting because Bush was always talked about he really shouldn't nominate a true conservative. Well, you've got a situation where you've got a president who voted against John Roberts, who is more than qualified because of judicial philosophy. I think Sonia Sotomayor was a great pick for him. I mean, elections mean things. But you're looking for a fight right now when it comes to Supreme Court nominees, if he's going to pick somebody that isn't. I mean, remember, Obama was supposed to be the great unifier, to reach across the aisle with people. And if he goes far to the left, especially after him not voting for Alito or Roberts, I think there is going to be a big battle. And I think that's when he may lose, because his poll numbers are already down.
There's two different issues. The deficit is clearly an important issue politically. Economists disagree on how much it matters in the short term, and some say higher deficits to generate economic growth are a good thing, and that's part of what's gotten us out of where we were when this election took place back in 2008. That said, it's without question there are fears about the deficit. It's not all caused by Barack Obama. You know, a lot of both the spending and the tax cuts under President Bush really are at the heart of this. That said, it's under President Obama's watch now, and I do think the administration is planning to deal with that issue. There's many stories coming out. That's what they're going to focus on, all kinds of spending reductions, including issues like Medicare and Social Security, and I think the president is sensitive to that. On the Supreme Court pick, there's no reason liberal and unqualified have to go together. I think most of the picks who have been floated, like Alana Kagan or Diane Wood or Merrick Garland, are all highly qualified people, as qualified as Justice Roberts. So it's possible for him to pick someone who has, you know, totally strong and unquestionable professional credentials, but still, shares a broader judicial philosophy that Democrats tend to support. The Supreme Court nominees happen to be activists just of a rightward kind, and that's how presidents pick on both parties pick their nominees. So, you know, President Obama has tried a strategy often where he doesn't want to get a fight, and it hasn't really done very well for him. The more he's tried to please Republicans, it seems the worst they're willing to bite his hand. We saw that on health care. We saw that on the stimulus. And my sense is the administration doesn't want to get tricked again.
Hmm. Thank you, Scott, for the call. So that means it will continue beyond possibly liberal Supreme Court nominee, that he will become more liberal in the months ahead?
I think so. Or it doesn't always have to be liberal. But I think the strategy of trying to court that elusive Republican vote in the Senate to gain over 60 votes to end the filibuster, if that's how we think of it, I think he's starting to kind of lose patience in a strategy that focuses on that. Instead, he wants to focus on kind of a winning strategy, one that will make him look strong, one that will put Republicans on the defensive, meaning making them make the arguments about why what the president is doing is wrong. I think he's kind of tired and frustrated about courting Republicans who won't vote for him. And so that's my sense. It will continue in other policy areas.
Jim from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I'd like to talk about deregulation and safety. And I think most of the people in the listening audience have had a situation where they held a child's hand when they were crossing the street. And the reason we did that is because we wanted to be the kid to be safe. It was a nurturing and protective and caring thing to do. But to conservatives, the word safe in association with government regulation is a symbolic four-letter word, because they want to regulate the poor, but they certainly don't want to regulate the business. And we liberals know that coal mining and stock investing involve risk. But if the government, we also know that if the government allows coal miners like mines like Massey and investment firms like Goldman Sachs to cheat people on issues of safety, that in relative terms, coal miners' daughters and investors will suffer, and that's not right. And so I'd like to ask the listening conservatives if they feel that, how's that conservative concept of deregulation working out for you? Do you want to turn tea parties into conventions for anarchists? Did the Lord give Moses a list of the 10 suggestions? It seems to me that laws are meant to be enforced.
Professor Zelizer.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is the flip side to the call we heard earlier from an opponent of government, and it's the idea which has been behind the New Deal, the Great Society, and many of our government programs that not all risk is acceptable, and that the government's role is to try to mitigate some of the risks that Americans have to take. It doesn't mean a government-controlled economy, but we don't want people to have to lose all their money or face perilous safety conditions just because of some belief in the free market. The history of the Republican Party demonstrates that it is not a party that actually abides by that. The government is often called on by the Republicans to prevent certain kinds of risks. So it's really about priorities, which risks we want to protect against and which we want to allow, you know, markets or other avenues to, you know, just to move forward with without any kind of protection. So I think, you know, that is the argument, but I think many Democrats feel that conservatives have to answer that question. You know, how much risk should an average American be forced to confront? And that's been the argument about government in the 20th century.
Thanks very much, Jim, for your call. Bill from Morrison. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to say, I think our President Obama is taking a lot of heat for a lot of actions that I don't particularly think is necessary. He was handed a full plate that I don't know how many people could even attempt to handle it. And I think he's doing a very great job. And I think that...
Goodness, Bill, what's going on?
What?
Where are you?
Oh, I deliver water.
Oh, okay. There was some water being delivered. Go ahead.
And I believe that the tea parties are probably one of the best things that could have happened to the country, just for the simple fact that it gets that normal everyday folk involved in government more so than they would have been at any other time.
Professor,
I had trouble hearing part of the question, so. Could you just repeat that, the main question?
Do you want to talk, there were two parts. One is that at least the Tea Partiers are, you know, involved in government. Yep. That's a good thing. The other thing was really essentially the full plate that Obama was given, and he's doing an admirable job.
Right. The first part, yes. I mean, look, it's true. You know, if you inherit a recession, a severe recession, a financial meltdown, and two wars, it's not the kind of presidency you want to step into. You want peace and prosperity, because then you can move on to the issues that you came into office fighting for rather than the issues which were handed to you. That said, that argument runs out a few months into office. They are now President Obama's problems, and I don't think, you know, that helps him at all, and he has to deal with the problems he has. That's what all presidents have to do. The second part, there is a good element about it. Obviously, if there's a kind of movement that engages people in the political process, gets them to think about political issues and to go out and support candidates, that's a good thing. Left or right, we want people to participate, but we don't want it to get into a dangerous situation. There's sometimes kind of civic participation leads to bad things. And there are elements of the Tea Party, I think it's undeniable, that play to radical and violent elements in American politics. The left has these elements, but the Tea Party movement has it. And with an African-American president, it only heightens the tension we're hearing. I think President Clinton has been spot on when he said there has to be a difference between people coming out and complaining about government and people coming out and vilifying government as literally an evil. He's talked about this in recent days, remembering Oklahoma City.
Right.
And we have to make sure that civic participation doesn't cross the line.
Thank you, Bill, for the call. Don from Marshfield. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Don.
Hi. See, I want to speak a little bit about public financing of campaigns, which I think relates very much to what we've been talking about. You know, it's very frustrating to me, it has been, I think, to a lot of people. Will people put two and two together and realize that, of course, the Congress does not work for the people. It works for those who pay their campaign bills and keep them in office. Some of us have the old-fashioned idea that, you know, government policies should be based on evidence of efficacy of policies and persuasive arguments rather than which lobbyist brings the big, you know, biggest bag of campaign cash. You know, this general anger at politicians has been around forever. People don't like politicians, and they don't like paying for their campaigns. But you know, if the people don't want to pay for government for political campaigns, don't expect the the policies government comes up with to reflect their needs or their interests. He who pays the piper calls the tune. It's that simple. But it's very frustrating because people don't, that doesn't seem to get through people's, this layer of people have their anger at politicians, which has been going on for a long time. If you bring this up, people say, I don't want to pay for their campaign bills because they're all corrupt. Well, if you don't want to, Citigroup, Caldwell Banker, they're happy to step in and pay for those campaigns, and the resultant policies will, of course, be those that reflect the interests of those entities.
Mm. Professor?
I think it's absolutely true. I mean, my only the difference I would have, I do think many politicians are as frustrated with this system as citizens, meaning they don't like what they have to do, they don't like the limits of what they can do, and they don't like having to fundraise all the time. But if you want a different kind of politics, you need to change the way politics works. And there are specific issues. It's not all vague, you know, we want government to be better. The campaign finance system relies on large contributions and the power of interest groups. So we can't expect anything but a health care bill that has the imprint of the pharmaceutical industry, of the hospitals, if we don't change the way the campaign finance system works. And that requires citizens to vote for legislators and presidents who will stick by those reforms, to call for those kinds of reforms, and to push for real change once people are elected. Until you have that, the process remains the same. And that goes from the power of private money to partisanship in Washington. All that will remain regardless of who's elected because you have a process that supports those trends.
Professor Zelizer, always a great pleasure to have you on the air. Thank you so much for being with us. Our guest this hour, Professor Julian Zelizer. He's a semi-regular, I guess you could describe him that way, on All Things Political, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, author of a number of books, including most recently Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. It was a particularly busy day on email and also on phone. So if you'd like to post some comments, go to our Facebook page and people can read them. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. So we'd like to hear from you. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to John Treader for on-air production. And thank you, as always, for your stimulating calls. News ahead will return here on the Ideas Network.